Every so often, it helps to pause in what we're doing and realize we live in a truly special place on the planet. We have mountains, rivers, forests, the ocean nearby. It's a bit of a wonderland. Like the old Oregon license plate said, Pacific Wonderland. We get impressions on the land and the activities in it from a collection of essays by Nick Neely, who put them together in his book, Coast Range, a collection from the Pacific Edge. The book includes salmon and steelhead, hummingbirds and hatcheries, agate hunting and gold dredging. Nick Neely is a Coast Range native, California style. He grew up on the bayside of the Santa Cruz Mountains, exploring the woodlands and chaparral. His nonfiction work has been widely published in the likes of Audubon and High Country News. Somehow, for all of his love of the Coast Range, Nick and his wife Sarah Bird now live in Idaho. Nick Neely, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. So kind of you to have me.
Great to have you. And the first question, obviously, is why do you live in Idaho if you love the Coast Range so much?
That's a really good question, and it happened mainly by chance. But my family has spent time in Idaho for a long time, so I went up there a lot as a kid. And we were actually thinking about settling in Oregon. My wife is a landscape painter, and Oregon calls out to her as well in a major way, but we were a little bit spooked. We were thinking about settling on the Oregon coast at least temporarily, and then the all the buzz about the possible tsunami came to our ears, and we ended up just settling, because since we're both working as freelancers, in Haley, Idaho, which is also quite beautiful, but sagebrush instead of temperate rainforest or big trees.
Was it the New Yorker piece by Catherine Schultz?
Yeah, which is such an incredible piece, and as a writer, something I really admire.
I only laugh because it took a piece in the New Yorker to tell the world what the Pacific Northwest is known for a while, and she won a Pulitzer for it, too.
Yeah, I know.
So for your book, The Coast Range, are these essays you wrote over many years or more recent works?
Most of them are fairly recent. A lot of them I began while I was in New York City, as far as possible from Southern Oregon as possible. And I was getting an MFA at the Columbia University Writing Program, and writing about my summer experiences, and I was journeying back to Oregon to gather material to write about. And sometimes I find it's easier to write about places you're not in currently, or experiences you've had some time ago. This book really began when I was lucky enough to receive a 6-month writing residency in 2009 on the Rogue River outside of Galice, outside of Grants Pass.
Is it the Marjorie Davis Boyden residency?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was on a remote homestead off the grid, high above the Rogue River. And I didn't write about the place at the time. But came back to it years later, and eventually, the biggest essay in the book is a memoir about my time, our time. My wife was also at the homestead with me, that was actually the last piece that I wrote. It sort of brought all the other essays together.
You know, we have, I went back and looked because I remembered hearing about this residency before. We talked to another writer named Steve Edwards who spent time there. Is there an alumni association of people who have had the Marjorie Davis Boyden Wilderness Writing Residency?
There is, unofficially, and we're all occasionally looped on an email, and I hope there will be a reunion eventually, or actually I think it would be quite appropriate to start to put together an anthology as this remote spot really, more and more people have written about it, and in different ways, and it would just be fascinating to put everyone's take together.
That really would, to have a Rogue River anthology. I look forward to seeing your name as the editor on that collection.
Yeah, someone will have to take the lead.
Mm-hmm. So obviously the Coast Range is your home terrain, but as an adult who moved away, is it easier then to articulate what it is that makes this part of the world so alluring, so worth writing about?
Yeah, I suppose this could be said about a lot of places, but the Coast Ranges, they just have, they're very intimate, their scale is relatively modest, their heights aren't terribly high, but there's a lot of what I like to call sort of edginess to them. They come right down to the sea. You can be, from the beach to the top of them in just a couple of minutes in some cases, and they have sort of a subtle a subtle loveliness to them as well that has always really called to me, and won't call to people who love, you know, high peaks and or, you know, severe ruggedness. And the ranges, you know, they sort of weave together. They go all the way from Baja up through Canada, and so there's sort of a loose chain that you can follow, and each has a different ecology.
You know, this is not just a woodsy travelogue by a long shot. In fact, the first essay is on chitin, which is what?
Chitin is a sort of a semi-obscure mollusk that you would find in tide pool environments, and there are many, many species of them, and they kind of creep along on their bellies and graze the algae, and mainly they're overlooked. They sort of look like rocks, but they captured my attention, and the chitin, that first essay sort of became a metaphor for the writer's work, sort of a little bit obscure, and sort of making forays out and back from a home dimple, as I put it in the essay. I like to think of the collection as sort of one chitin's territory, the forays I've made in different directions from one spot.
I love the nickname for gumboot chitin.
Yeah, the wandering meatloaf.
Exactly. And there's a belly flop maneuver we'll talk about, which kind of mimics the ways that the chitin move. So learn a lot about chitin here. We'll talk about the belly flop maneuver and what that got you as a from a perspective sense, and talk more about the essays. Nick Neely is our guest on The Exchange. His book is called Coast Range, A Collection from the Pacific Edge. We'll talk more with him, and you can join us as well as share stories of the Coast Range and the Rogue River Country, where he spent a lot of time for these essays. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Nick Neely and you in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Nick Neely, who lives in Idaho but loves the Coast Range and wrote a series of essays about it. He called his collection of essays, not surprisingly, Coast Range, A Collection from the Pacific Edge. A lot of time spent in the Rogue River Country visiting people and creatures and operations and places. It's a great perusal of what goes on in and around our region. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange and swap some stories about moments out in the wild. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So I want to come back to the first essay, which is about chitin, these little-known mollusks that are, they look quite prehistoric. We just talked about the gumboot chitin, mm-hmm. which is called the wandering meatloaf. But you recommend a belly flop maneuver at sunset on the beach. What have you seen and heard this way?
Well, I think a belly flop at any hour is effective. And I think really the point I was trying to make is that, and what the point that the book makes is that it just pays so much to look closely and to wait just a while, especially when you're trying to observe wildlife, but truly anything, you know, just sitting in one place can be so rewarding. And of course, you know, flopping on your belly, the idea there is that one sort of transforms and feels what the chitin's life, transforms into a chitin, or feels what it's like to be small and in that environment. So I also think that's one suggestion of the book, is to try to empathize with animals and other people.
You write in the piece, The Book of Agate, that you have collected places all your life, which is a charming phrase. What does it mean?
Well, I think, you know, one sort of tension in nature writing, if then that's what Coast Range really is between, you know, being in one place and sort of experiencing a range of habitats, and I think sort of coming into adulthood is sort of about finding one's own place, and sometimes that turns out to be exactly where you grew up, and sometimes it's somewhere else, and I think, you know, the more places you visit, the more perspective you have about what the charms of a particular place, such as the Coast Range, and I also think it's just sort of an intuitive response as well.
Well, you, the Chamber of Commerce in Yahats, Oregon, will be thrilled to find that it seems like Yahats is the jewel of your collection.
Yeah. Yahats is such a beautiful spot that you know, my wife and I felt like as if we'd had discovered, and I know everyone who goes through there has that same sensation. And they have a winter agate festival also that I'm hoping maybe in the coming years to visit and read this essay. It would be great. Very appropriate.
So for the people who've never hunted for agates, I mean, what are they and where do you look for them?
Well, they're basically quartz, a form of quartz called chalcedony. And they come, you know, of course, that rock, that mineral comes in all different colors. And people probably better know geodes, which have an empty interior and sort of teeth-like crystals often in that hollow. And agate is simply that material, but usually the little nodule or egg is solid. And these come out of the mountains where they form, and they tumble to the beach, and they're polished. And you can just find them among, big strands of rock cobble.
So it's almost like nature's own rock tumbler.
Yeah, exactly. And this essay, I wrote it. It's written in short fragments and that move very associatively, and it's meant to mimic, of course, a tumbler.
We're talking to Nick Neely about his collection of essays called Coast Range, a collection from the Pacific Edge here on the Jefferson Exchange. Wow, so much covered in here. There's one essay called The Afterlife, which takes us to the Coal River's fish hatchery at Lost Creek Dam on the Rogue. Just describe what you saw in there.
I would recommend a visit to that hatchery or any hatchery. Just seeing those big fish arrive from such a long journey. You see salmon up to 20 or more than 20 pounds climb a ladder into a collecting pool where some are selected to be bred for future generations of hatchery-born salmon, and others aren't so lucky and are disposed of, basically, because they're dubbed excess. So this essay, I followed some of those excess trout over the divide into the Umpqua watershed. They were taken there by members of the Cow Creek tribe of Umpqua Band of Indians, and through a casino kitchen to eventually their annual powwow where a salmon ceremony was performed, an initiation rite for the young braves. And one of these salmon was at the center of the ceremony, and others of them were, all of them were enjoyed by the tribe ultimately at a dinner.
But it really is an interesting afterlife, as you put it, because the bodies leave the hatchery. Then so why the Seven Feathers Casino Kitchen?
Well, that's the big kitchen that belongs to the Cow Creek Band, and so I was just along for the ride. Really, I wanted to see the afterlife journey of these fish, and the Cow Creeks were nice enough to have me along. And you wouldn't think that they would pass through the casino kitchen, but they had everyone on hand there in their white garb to sort of clean these fish properly and wrap them up and leave them in the freezer for the powwow.
So to back up a step, though, to the hatchery, because you go into the late life cycle of the salmon, which is always fascinating to me anyway. But, I mean, the way they get the Chinook salmon get the hook bills and change their appearance. I knew they stopped eating once they got in the river, but what happens inside of them? What's going on with their guts?
Well, they actually, their priorities change entirely, and so their gut just sort of atrophies and shrivels up to nothing, and in its place, their reproductive organs swell, and the females generate a beautiful cluster of orange eggs, which they carry up the river, and the males melt, and then in doing so, they basically have given up their future lives. They're investing entirely in their offspring.
It's completely about reproduction at that point. No other bodily functions really matter.
Yeah, they just become a vessel for their progeny.
Wow. So the sorting process inside the hatchery, did that make you a little squeamish at all, or is it all just you figured part of life?
It might make some squeamish, but there was no blood there, and Actually, more than anything, it was simply impressive to just see the size of these fish and see them out of the water. And they were sort of sorted by size, and some of them were selected. Just tried to maintain a diverse gene pool. They selected a range of sizes for future breeding, and the rest were given to tribes.
So it's not just saying, oh, the big ones are the ones that we're going to keep here.
Oh no, they take little ones. They take there's one life form called the jack, which is basically a salmon that's come back earlier that's maybe half the size of the others, and they take some of those too.
It's pretty impressive to stand back though and take a look at what is being assumed here. I mean, the life cycle of the salmon that was uninterrupted for thousands and thousands of years, perhaps even more than that, with humans alongside. Taking them into salmon ceremonies, but now it involves a hatchery and a casino kitchen to get them back to the salmon ceremony.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the journey of salmon in the last couple hundred years has been really, really twisting from, total devastation in some places. It's and the population has been replaced by hatchery populations, the wild population. I wanted the essay to really sort of embody this sort of strange moment we're in now, where the wild is not compromised, but humans have a hand in it so much, and I think that's reflected in the route this ceremony takes.
We're talking to Nick Neely about his collection of essays called Coast Range, a collection from the Pacific Edge. Nick grew up in the Santa Cruz Mountains south of the Bay Area on the Bayside, enjoying the Coast Range and learning to love it, and has explored quite a bit of it for the essays in this book. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about Nick's work or maybe share some stories of your own and some impressions you've made over the years from living in and traveling through this region. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Just in general terms about the essays, did you write a bunch that didn't actually make it into the book, or is this the whole collection?
I wrote a couple, and some of them I didn't even finish. They were just ideas that didn't quite come to completion. Actually, how it came about is after my time in the homestead, I went to High Country News as an intern, which is their environmental magazine based out of Colorado, and there I started looking for things to write about, stories, and since I had just spent time in the region, some of the way excess salmon are used occurred to me that would be great to write about, and also suction gold dredging popped to mind, and so I then made these forays back to do that.
Well, yeah, that was where I was going to go next, was to talk about the suction dredging, because that particular essay is called Gone Rogue or Suck It Up.
Uh-huh.
I get the sense from this essay that your traveling sometimes involves some whims and hunches.
Yeah, absolutely. And that I actually did that just after I was at the Cow Creek powwow. I was driving away from that, and I knew that there were people dredging on that portion of the Rogue near Gold Hill. And I had some time in my hands. This was during a summer between years in my Master of Fine Arts program in New York. So I just veered off the road, not knowing exactly what to expect, and was lucky to encounter some dredgers who were willing to, just have me stay with them for, I think it was 4 days in the end, and just learn their trade. And as a as an environmentalist, I was, skeptical at first, and I remain skeptical of the activity, but I wanted to give it a fair shake and really, really come to understand what they were doing.
And this is along the Rogue near Gold Hill. Was it the first time you had seen suction dredges at work?
I had passed by them, but I had not gotten close enough to really understand what they were. I actually, while I was at the homestead where my writing residency was, I visited the Armadillo Mining Shop in Grants Pass, which is a somewhat famous place for miners in the region, and I saw the strange looking dredges there.
Huh. So the encounter with the guy you call Dave here seems like I can certainly understand it based on what's happened legally and otherwise,
right,
lately, but it sounds like Dave was not necessarily welcoming to you.
Yeah, I didn't.
Whoops, we have lost Nick Neely. That is the sound of a phone getting hung up. I'm not sure what happened there. We're going to get him back on the phone. His book is called Coast Range, A Collection from the Pacific Edge. It's really a chance to get a bit of a travelogue from Nick Neely about the places he has gone, not only in the Rogue River country, but all over the region, because Coast Range, in his sense, actually starts where he grew up on the Bay Area side of the Santa Cruz Mountains, exploring the woodlands and the chaparral. He's written a bunch of nonfiction work for Audubon, for High Country News, and a number of other publications, including Three Penny Review and Kenyon Review and the Georgia Review and Ecotone. So all kinds of stuff from Nick Neely back here on the Jefferson Exchange with us. You there, Nick?
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry about that.
No problem. So we were talking about this guy named Dave.
Right.
He says, you're sure asking a lot of questions.
Yeah, I mean, I just sort of showed up. I think miners are a wary sort to begin with. And then I really, you know, I think I might have said right away that I was a writer. I can't recall, really. Maybe I didn't. Maybe I was just sort of asking probing questions. But, you know, they don't want to reveal their secrets if you're another dredger, or maybe I was some other authority that it was just snooping around in plain clothes. But I was just a harmless writer, and really I just wanted to know the nuts and bolts of how it worked, and there's a lot of that in the essay. I think people in the region who are curious about how dredging, suction gold mining works, will like the essay.
Was this about the time that Oregon was clamping down on suction dredges?
It was a little bit before that, but yeah, it was already in the air. And then, yeah, only a couple of years later, it was put on hiatus. It had already been clamped down on in California, and that's why there was a little boom in southern Oregon. All the California miners had come north and were looking around for a new spot.
So some guys, I mean, ultimately, they did open up to you. For all their time and effort, I mean, how much stuff did they ever haul out of the river?
Well, you know, it's hard to get a straight answer about that. And, you know, in the same way that a fisherman is not going to exactly tell you the truth about how big the fish was or where they got their best fish because they want to keep those spots secret, I think miners are also guarded. But certainly enough to cover their costs and make it worth their while. And if they do find a pay streak, it can be, you know, thousands of dollars a week. So, it all depends.
And did any of them tell you that they'd ever found actual big nuggets? I mean, or is it all just sort of flakes now?
No, they had found nuggets in other places, and using metal detectors is what I heard. But yeah, in this portion of the Rogue, at least, they were just sort of siphoning up gold dust. But that can add up. And as I write in the essay, they told me that, you know, this was the type of material that the early gold miners were ignoring and couldn't recover, and so they were just sort of coming in and sifting through the even smaller stuff.
It's pretty clear from this essay called Gone Rogue or Suck It Up that you've done lots of research. I mean, do you think dredging can be done with little environmental damage?
I think it could be. Really, to my mind, it is just about limiting the number of people who are doing it and probably spreading them out up and down the river, so that if you do too much of anything in one place, it's not good for the environment. But yes, I do think that it probably could be done with regulation. But you know, regulating anything is also harder, easier said than done. So that should be part of the calculus too.
Yeah, you can lay down rules, but when people are underwater, you don't necessarily know that they're
obeying them. Yeah, absolutely.
Did you get to see the process underwater, Nick?
Yeah, I did. At first, I just borrowed a mask and stuck my face into the water. We were only about waist deep, and my nose was tingling. And then actually, they let me take the hose of the dredge, and I did it myself for about 40 minutes on my last day with them, which was just an amazing and somewhat scary experience that I finished the essay with. So yeah, I've actually done it myself.
So the oft-mentioned thing from the miners about the fact that fish seem to hang around the exhaust part of this, did you see that happening too?
Yeah, I did. I did see fish. You know, they're not right under your hands per se, but I saw them off to the side, and I know I would not be surprised if they weren't eating things that were stirred up. But, you know, that particulate also has some negative effects further down the river potentially.
Sure. And ultimately, this gets us back to the basic nub. I mean, you definitely make us think in this essay about why in God's name we place so much value on this shiny metal in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. And I basically, I mean, there are lots of ways of answering that question, but perhaps the most whimsical or literary and my preferred answer is that really it's just our fascination with light and the way we are drawn to shininess that it makes gold valuable.
Oh, good heavens, we're magpies.
Yes, absolutely.
We like the shiny things. All right, back but to talk more with Nick Neely about his collection of essays called Coast Range, A Collection of the Pacific Edge. Lots of great observations about life in the Coast Range and near it. A lot of it in the Rogue River Valley, as you heard, even as far up the Rogue River as the Coal River's Fish Hatchery. We'll get back to that hatchery, actually, before we're done here with Nick. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more about the Coast Range with Nick Neely and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the author Nick Neely, the essayist. He's put together a collection of his essays from the Pacific Edge. It's actually subtitled A Collection from the Pacific Edge. The title is Coast Range. Nick Neely is our guest. You can join us as we talk about his observations about life in the Rogue River country, where he spent a fair amount of time, including at the Wilderness Writing Residency in a cabin on the Rogue River itself. But he also grew up in the Santa Cruz Mountains south of San Francisco, so all kinds of observations about the places where the ocean and the forest and the mountains meet. You can join us on the exchange as we talk about his observations and perhaps some of your own as well about this wonderful place we call home. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There's an essay in here called Discovering Anna, and there's my question right atop paragraph 3. Who's Anna?
Anna was, well, the Anna of the essay is Anna's Hummingbirds, and that hummingbird is named after a duchess, somewhat obscurely. She was the Duchess of Rivoli, and she was named by an explorer named René Primevère Lesson, who explored the West Coast in 1822, but actually found this hummingbird in the collection of a duke later on as he put together a monograph of hummingbirds.
And it's just called Anna's Hummingbird?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Anna's Hummingbird, and it's found up and down the coast. I assume they're found in the Rogue Valley, but I'm actually not sure I've ever seen one there. So could be wrong. I know they're found all along the coast.
So when I read about your various childhood fascinations in this particular essay, I wondered if you came close at some point to becoming a scientist.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought, through high school and then into college that I would study biology. I ended up journeying from California to Rhode Island, where I went to Brown University. And there, they have a smaller biology program, no offerings in ornithology, which is my particular fascination studying birds, and they had an incredible undergraduate nonfiction writing program that was somewhat experimental. You could really be playful in your work. So I drifted towards writing.
It sounds like you had a bit of a museum in your house as a kid.
Yeah, it was a modest museum. You know how things loom larger as when you're a child, but I had a little extra bureau full of little things that I'd found and that my parents had helped me find along the way, shells and feathers and a lot from the backyard, but then also from travels.
Did a lot of your physical discoveries lead you to scientific research? I mean, it sounds like you were pretty good at cracking books or getting into, I assume this was pre-internet time, and into finding out more about the stuff you'd found.
I came to research gradually, and I've developed some through school, but also just through my own interests, some scientific literacy, so that I could read a scientific paper and glean from it as a writer. And I think that's been invaluable to my writing, to be able to do that and to actually to know that if you string together enough facts, you can create something really interesting. And the Anna's Hummingbird essay is really just relishes in how amazing these birds are. And you learn about Anna's Hummingbird from every angle.
What is so special about the Anna's Hummingbird?
Well, it's hard to know where to start, but one cool fact is that they could be considered the fastest animal known to us. They do this courtship dive where they rise into the sky and then power down, plummet down towards a female sitting in a bush, they go down at something like 60 miles per hour, and their body is so small that if you think of that in terms of their body length, they're faster than peregrine falcons, they're faster than a fighter jet.
Wow, that is impressive. So this is really, it sounds like drag racing for hummingbirds. It's like, hey, watch this, honey.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's all for show. It's all bravado.
The native tales that you bring in to this essay about hummingbirds are impressive. I mean, what kinds of things did they attribute to these birds?
Well, yeah, hummingbirds have a remarkable place in indigenous Native American mythology. Some tribes, there's one story about how it was hummingbird that poked holes in the darkness of night and created stars. And a more local here in the Bay Area, one tribe believes that hummingbird was responsible for stealing fire back from the badger people who had taken it underground, and that's how its brilliant red throat came to be. That in stealing this fire back, its plumage had caught fire, and it still is burning.
Huh, that's fun. I want to talk about some of the other essays here, like The Garden of Our Earthly Delights, which features one of the trees that's unique to the region and really impressive, the madrone. Lots of names for it with that, where the bark falls off and it gets all twisty and orange looking, but you call them refrigerator trees, or did. What was that about?
Well, they have a really thin bark, and so you can feel the sap actually just flowing right underneath the skin. And yeah, growing up, we have madrones here in the Bay Area as well. Growing up as a kid, docents or teachers used to tell us to hug the tree and it would cool you off and refrigerate you. And that's true. It does feel like that.
Oh, it's just something else again. We go back to the hatchery for a piece called Carcass Toss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So here we get a chance to get inside the Coal M River's fish hatchery at Lost Creek Dam once again. What kinds of things go? What is the carcass toss, though?
It's another use for these excess salmon and steelhead. And this essay focuses on steelhead, but it's also done with excess salmon. But basically, the carcasses of these fish are thrown back into creeks to basically fertilize them. And the goal is to sort of simulate the natural die-off that once occurred with wild populations of salmon. They would have gone way up into the watershed and died in small creeks, and their bodies are essentially packets of fertilizer that not only is good for the forest, but the forest really, really relied on. And so just sort of returning that as we can is a great idea.
Does that get a wee bit smelly when you get out to the creeks? And...
Yeah, it's a gory essay, but I think it's also it's a fun essay too, and there's a lot of humor that goes on in this process.
Yeah. Well, boy, some of the stuff like the stunning stages and things like that within the hatchery too, so they can make sure that the fish, it sounds like, if they're not stunned electrically, can cause injury to the people who work with them.
Yeah, they're so heavy that when they're collecting them or sorting them, they just stun them lightly to subdue them temporarily, and then they quickly measure them and decide what their use will be, and they all go back into tanks at least temporarily before they just sort of amp the voltage on the braille in order to finally kill them and then throw them, in this case, in the case of carcass tossing, back into creeks.
You know, I've watched the process actually with very young salmon, where they basically inject coated wire into the snouts of the salmon, and so those actually come into play when the fish are at the end of their lives at the hatchery. What do the coated wires do?
Yeah, they basically they pass them through a coated wire detector, and if they have a wire, then they send the fish to a laboratory just to study it further to see. To learn what they can learn from it, and then they also know, of course, where it came from. So they just want to know how old it is, and did it come from the hatchery that it left from?
It's quite the fish factory, then, isn't it? The hatchery.
Yeah, it's a really marvelous place, fascinating, and you can go to the hatchery. It's open to the public, and look in into the hatchery house, that room where they do the collecting through a glass window, and you can also just wander in if you go down below too. The employees there are super friendly, and they just want to teach you about fish.
Mm-hmm. And there are all those ponds outside as well where fish come back in.
Yeah, it's certainly worth a visit, and it's one of the few places where you're likely to see salmon unless you spend time fishing.
Truly. Of all the places, we talked about Yahats being yours and your wife Sarah Bird's favorite place in this coast range. Is there a second favorite, or anything even close to Yahats?
I really do love the Rogue Valley. That homestead will always have a special place in my heart, though it's hidden away. I'm still learning very much about Oregon, and I've only lived there that one stint. I actually spent a summer in Eugene when I was in college. I was a runner in college, and so Eugene was a bit of a mecca, and I went there with some friends to train, and maybe that kicked off my fascination with Oregon. I think all of the Coast Ranges are special.
We had a couple of questions about this from a couple of listeners. Jeannie in Medford wanted to talk about the Big Sur and Carmel by the Sea, where she spent some time there and had never thought about how the forest could need the ocean nearby. What do you know about that interrelationship? Seems like with redwoods, it's a particularly strong connection.
Yeah, well, sure. The redwoods, of course, are famous for they sort of act as sails or sieves that collect fog, moisture that comes off the ocean and feed their roots. And then, of course, where there are steelhead, and Big Sur is so rugged that in that particular place, there are sort of modest steelhead populations going up those creeks. It's so steep into those mountains. But the trees are important to stabilizing those creeks, those rivers, which steelhead depend on. So it really all is a cycle. I actually happened to walk through Big Sur on the highway there for my next book project, which is a long walk from San Diego to San Francisco. So Big Sur is fresh in my mind, though it's not in this collection.
So do you actually made a walk from San Diego to San Francisco?
Yeah. For my next book, I'm taking up another part of the coast. And I spent 12 weeks retracing the first Spanish expedition into California. And they left San Diego and arrived at San Francisco. They were the first Europeans to see San Francisco Bay before they turned around and went back. But that's another book to come.
So you traced what eventually became the Camino Real?
Well, it actually predates that, because this is the Bertola expedition that left in 1769, and they were looking for mission sites. So it's not exactly the El Camino Real, and they veered inland off the coast wherever mountains came down to the sea. We can drive the Big Sur stretch now, but that was impossible until not too long ago, as it relatively speaking. So it was a very varied experience. Took me inland through agricultural valleys as well.
Now, I noticed that you grew up in Portola Valley. Were you interested in finding out who was behind the name Portola?
Yeah, absolutely. This project, which I'm calling Alta California, that was the name of the region back then, really is about sort of learning the history I probably should have learned in elementary school and middle school. And but it actually, my interest in the Bertola expedition came out of Coast Range, and I mentioned Bertola a couple times in the book, in the Discovering Anna essay, and then also in the Madrone essay, The Garden of Earthly Delights. the Bartolo expedition gave the Madrone its name, and I discovered that in the writing of this essay. And then my brain started turning over. I started to think, well, if they named the Madrone, what else did they name, and what else were they the first to see?
Huh. Okay. And how long did it take you to make the journey yourself? And was it just strictly a walk, or was it a walk and a drive and a walk and a drive?
It was strictly a walk. It was 12 weeks. 12 weeks with a backpack, and there's no trail per se, but it also, you know, they named Los Angeles, so I went right through some really, really urban areas. It doesn't get more urban than Los Angeles, and then I made I walked some miles through open space, or a lot of miles through open space, and into wilderness also.
I don't want to get you thinking too far ahead here, but would your next book then be in the Redwoods, or maybe would you go even farther north to the Olympics?
I don't know. I don't know if there'll be a walking sequel to Alta California, but my walk was only half of California. It's just amazing to think about how tall the state is.
How many pairs of shoes in 12 weeks?
I only went through two pairs of running shoes. I probably should have gone through few more. Would have been easier on my feet.
There's a fun mix of science and humor and human interest, all kinds of stuff in Coast Range, a collection from the Pacific Edge, which is the book by Nick Neely. He'll be talking tomorrow night at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland at 7 p.m., and I want to thank him for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Nick, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Jeffrey. Thanks so much.
Sure. Take care.